This is Mike Dilk of Relax Back UK.
Welcome to UK Health Radio and thank you for joining me, Mike Dilk, on the Relax Back UK show. This week we're looking at parts of the NHS. Now we all know it's under pressure, so I thought I'd look at some ways that we can all help to make the best use of the scarce resources within it, and also one way that GP surgeries are alleviating the demand on GP's time. I've spoken about social prescribing previously on this show, but this time I talked to a volunteer who runs the social prescribing programme for a busy GP practice in St Albans.
There's a plethora of organisations out there that can help in different things, and just finding the right one for the right circumstances is really quite tricky, but that is the essence of social prescribing.
The fact is that people may visit their GP when actually another sort of organisation, whatever that might be, could actually help them much better. So we explore how to hook them up with the right group or organisation, and that is essentially what social prescribing is, I think. Also, pharmacies can do a lot to help alleviate the demand for GPs.
And pharmacy is so accessible. I mean, Lloyd's Pharmacy, for example, has lots of pharmacies in supermarkets that are open from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. Pretty much Monday to Saturday, and open on Sundays as well.
They are knowledgeable and they're usually a lot more accessible than GPs, so they really are a good place to go for some medical help. So please do stick around for the rest of the Relax Back UK show.
UK is run by my daddy.
Shortly we're going to hear from Alan Bellinger, and he runs the social prescribing programme at the Maltings GP Surgery in St Albans. But before that, I just want to tell you about a book that my wife bought me recently, and it's called This Is Going to Hurt, Secret Diaries of a Junior Doctor by Adam Kay. And maybe it kind of highlights some of the issues that we're talking about here within the NHS, or certainly some of the strains within the NHS. And he really felt them. In fact, I think he's given up being a medic. He's not a doctor anymore. He does talk about some of the plus sides of being a doctor, some of the sort of warm and fuzzy feelings he gets. And I'll read a couple of extracts for you. Monday the 19th, September 2005. First vent house delivery. I suddenly feel like an obstetrician. It's a pretty notional job title until you can, you know, actually extract a baby. My registrar, Lily, talks me through it gently. But I do it all myself and it feels, I'm not sure I can say this bit, something great. Congratulations, you did amazingly well there, says Lily. Thank you, I reply. Then realise she's actually talking to the mum. So that's part of the warm, fuzzy side. And then there's a couple of days later, this is a sort of in a diary context. One diary entry that kind of highlights some of the issues of time problems where things might get glossed over a little bit. Wednesday the 16th of November, 2005. I glance at the notes before reviewing an elderly gynae patient on the ward round. Good news. Physio have finally been to see her. Bad news. The entry reads, patient too drowsy to assess. I pop in. The patient is dead. Okay, so you've got to be kind of in a hurry not to notice that your patient is dead. So I think probably the physios there were somewhat overstretched. But I do recommend the book. It's very funny. Maybe it does highlight some of the issues in the NHS. Currently, more in a hospital setting, I think, really. So now we're talking about in a GP setting, and I'd spent some time chatting to Alan Bellinger, and he's a volunteer and he runs the social prescribing program at the Maltings GP Surgery in St Albans. And I started off just by asking him, okay, so what actually is social prescribing?
Tends to be a little bit of a conundrum, but perhaps I can make it very simple. Because when I see someone in the surgery who's been referred to the social prescribing process, here's the way I define it to them. I say that you're very used to coming to the surgery with a medical condition and getting a medical prescription. So now you can come to the surgery with a social condition rather than a medical condition and still get a social prescription, because we refer you to social services that can help you, as opposed to medical prescriptions with a medicine to solve the problem.
Okay.
It's as simple as that. There's a very, very hard line between the medical conditions, which the healthcare professionals deal with, and social conditions, which are referred to us as social prescribing volunteers within the surgery.
Yeah, all right. And when you say social services, you don't mean social services as provided by the council, etc., do you? That's not what you mean.
I don't. There's a plethora of organisations out there that can help in different things. And just finding the right one for the right circumstances is really quite tricky, but that is the essence of social prescribing.
Okay.
That is a major part of the training program for someone that comes into social prescribing, is obviously to talk to people, to understand the condition, to empathize, to be non-judgmental, and all those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, you've got to say to them, well, you know, these are the sort of situations or organizations that can help you.
All right.
And most of those are voluntary organizations.
Well, perhaps we'll come on to the details of some of the different organisations that you might introduce people to. But keeping things general, what difference does it make to people? Have you actually seen this be a useful thing for people?
Oh, it's enormously helpful. As social prescribers, someone will come in, they'll come into the surgery. So we don't go, as volunteers, we don't go out to people's homes. The service is all surgery-based. And we'll see people who probably are very anxious, very nervous, have got some problems on there that they're dealing with at the moment. And so that session that we have with them can be up to an hour long. Which, you know, compare it to a normal doctor's session of 10 minutes, that's quite significant.
So they really get some time.
Yeah, so it'll be up to an hour. We try and keep it to about 50 minutes because we've got some paperwork to do, but that can drift if the situation needs. And the key thing is, it's giving them that time that is the enormous help to them.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
they'll come in, you know, and have all of the concerns, and they'll talk to you about those. And by talking them through and saying, well, look, this is really urgent, you need to get onto this, and here's an organisation that can help you, so let's do that first. And then perhaps we can look at this one next, and this sort of organisation can help you with that. And so you sort of break it down for them and provide different ways in which they can tackle the situation. And they'll go out thinking, now I'm very clear about what I need to do to resolve the situation. Yeah. So that's the real value.
Which can be half the problem. I mean, I know when I'm trying to deal with anything, almost.
Yeah.
I mean, it really can be anything from, you know, putting up shelves to dealing with my taxes. I just have to actually figure out what I need to do first and get on and do it. And very often I arrive at that solution by talking things through with my nearest sounding board, you know, and that's my wife.
Exactly. It's that value of really just talking it through.
Yeah.
And we can be enormously helpful in terms of then helping them see the wood for the trees.
Yeah, sure.
And when we say we make a prescription, what we will do is we'll get them in touch with the organisation that we think can help them and make the introduction for them. We don't simply say, ring this number or look at this website.
Yeah.
We try and get them involved because, you know, otherwise it could drift.
Sure. And how long has this programme been running at the clinic in St Albans?
Well, we've been running it for... We're coming up for 2 years. March 17, we first launched it. The surgery has around about 19,500 patients. And we've got around about 10 to 12 volunteers that have been trained up.
Mm-hmm.
We do two sessions a week, so it's not an onerous task for people.
And out of that 19,500 patients on the books, do you have a figure for how many that you've helped with this program?
Overall, I'd have to do the numbers, but we're typically seeing six to eight people a week.
Okay, so that's got to be a reasonable number.
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
So 30 a year. So, yeah. No, that's not right, is it?
No. So that'll be 50 times six, about, you know, 300 or something.
300, a section naught at the end. Sorry, the maths isn't working this morning.
So
Let me just explain.
Yeah.
We're called link workers. This is a very accepted term within social prescribing. And the role of a link worker is simply to refer to an agency. It's not to provide the service. It's to do that referring, so to help the individual prioritise the things that they should be looking at,
right,
and refer them to services that can help. So that's called a link worker role. NHS England have just published the long-term plan. At the end of January, there was part of that plan was specific drill down into social prescribing. And what they're looking at is to say that practices should have paid link workers within the practice. So for the next 2 to 3 years, the role will be to have a paid link worker within a practice.
Okay, all right.
So that bells the question, then what's the role of volunteers? And the discussions that I've had with our local commissioning group, which has basically been supporting us in doing this, is to say they want to have volunteers as well as paid link workers, because that makes the whole thing scalable.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And you said there are 10 volunteers?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, that's a sizable number of staff to find if the thing's going to keep going. If suddenly you've got to have, if these need to be paid members of staff, you know, that's not going to happen overnight, and it's also going to cost quite a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, I think the majority of volunteers are doing it because they want to give back to the surgery. So,
yeah,
it's a drive for the motivation is volunteering.
Yes.
No, and that's an excellent motivation.
And really, that link worker role is very nicely contained. So, from a volunteer's point of view, it's very clear what you can do and what you can't do. Medical is banned. and you're not in the business of solving the problem. You're in the business of referring people who can solve the problem. So it's nicely contained.
Following on from that, what sort of organisations will you refer people onto? You know, could it be anything? I mean, there are lots of voluntary organisations in St Albans, but, you know, how does it work? What do you do?
Well, if you take it from a St Albans perspective, there are around about 120 organisations on our database that we could refer to. Some of those are national. For example, if someone's having mental health problems, you'd refer them to Mind. If they're older and looking for some support, you'd refer them to Age UK. So you've got national organisations that are involved, but you've also got lots of local organisations as well. So so trying to find the right ones is... So there's a scheme in St Albans called the St Albans Good Neighbour Scheme. And so that would be typically an example of an organisation that we refer to. But that's purely a local organisation.
Right.
So
and what do they do?
St Albans Good Neighbour Scheme will, for example, do some befriending. They'll, if you've got to go to hospital urgency, they can provide you, and you can't get there in any other way, they can provide transport. So it's lots of things that can just help.
Yes.
So, but basically, when we're doing the consultation, what's going on in your head, what each of the organisations that I can refer to here. So you've got to have some sort of framework of reference as to how all that breaks down. So at the top level, we've got, it breaks down to things for families, things for children and young people, things for older people, mental health, carers, and bereavement and grief. So that's the top level breakdown. And then if you go down into families, for example, it's benefits and finance, legal, well-being and exercise, befriending, social support, all of that, and you sort of break it all down into all of those organisations.
Right.
So in your head, when you're doing these sessions, you're listening to what the patient is saying, but then you're thinking, well, this one would help, and this one would help, and this one would help, and then you can prioritise it. But you've got to have that sort of framework of reference, because finding them all out there, say there's about 120 organisations that we could refer to around St Albans.
Yeah.
Finding the right one
is
a bit of a nightmare.
No, I can imagine it is. But so you've got someone in front of you and you've been chatting to them for getting on for an hour, 45, 50 minutes, and you think, right, let's hook them up with these voluntary organisations. It might be one or two or whatever. What happens next? How do you sort of keep the momentum going to just make sure it happens rather than just drifts after the chat you have with the patient?
Well, we've developed a really light touch approach. We're in the business of referring them on rather than providing the solution. So yes. If we keep calling them back and saying, well, what are you doing about this and that and the other, we get on their nerves a bit. So what we tend to do is to call back after 3 months.
Right.
They know that if they need any help, they can contact us at any time. Because all of the notes are on file, any of the social prescribing people could deal with any situation. So it doesn't have to be the one that they dealt with previously. So they can contact us if they need, you know, what were you meaning about that? And who else? You said about this and that didn't work. So who else could I go to? Those sorts of conversations will go on in between times.
Yeah.
But after 3 months, we'll do a follow-up call. And we're not looking to say, well, we told you to do this, did you do it? Because it's not that sort of call. It's a call around how are things going now and you know, checking with them as to what's changed since we last saw them. And towards the end of that sort of conversation, which is very easy conversation to have, it's almost small talk to try and get into that. But at the end of that little bit of small talk, we'll hit them with one question, which is compared to when you, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is low and 10 is the highest, tell me how you're feeling now compared to when you came in to see me before. And we've been running that for 2 years, and the score that we have right now is 8.4.
Okay, all right. So that's a very positive thing, actually, because I was going to ask, you know, how do you know this is working? How do you know this is helping people as opposed to just a lot of hot air? But it seems that you've got some real statistical evidence that it's helping people.
That evidence is really very strong in terms of how they're feeling, their well-being and their state of mind. Yeah. Does that have a benefit to the health service? Well, that's more difficult to track because we know the people that have come in. It's all on the system. And so we can see so the question really is, does that mean they're having more doctor visits or less doctor visits? And there's no real pattern. Some of what we do see is the people that were what the patient, the surgery typically refers to as frequent flyers, people who come regularly, that tends to drop. But it does seem that people who don't come regularly actually come more often. There is a sort of very interesting correlation there. And I guess it's not surprising that if we deal with some of the social issues, then other issues can start coming to the fore.
Yeah.
And that's the reason that non-frequent flyers will tend to increase. So it's the quality of time that they have with the doctor rather than the amount of time.
Yeah. And if the objective is overall health of these 21,000 patients, then that's probably moving in the right direction. So fewer frequent flyers, more time to deal with people that actually, you know, really need some help.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's a really interesting sort of statistic. And I guess not really expected. We just thought it would mean less people coming. But it doesn't if you trap it down to those.
Have you been able to compare that with similar programs in other parts of the country at all?
We haven't really. We've been pretty focused on what we're doing.
Well, that's fair enough because, you know, you're a local charity. But at some point, let's put that out there. If anyone's listening and is interested in this sort of stuff, you could pull it all together from various parts of the country. That would be a very interesting thing to do, I'm sure.
Yep, that would be fascinating. And I'd be very supportive of that. So, anything we can do to get more data, more information, and more reactions to the benefits of social prescribing, that would be great.
Yeah, all right. Just moving back more to St Albans and your programme, do you need to be referred to this programme by a GP?
Yes, but not exclusively. the situation we have within the Malting surgery is that anyone within the surgery can refer someone to social prescribing. So the nurses, reception, anyone can do that referral. But also we have a big notice up in the surgery, so people can also self-refer.
All right, okay.
So it comes from all ways.
Yeah. And do people self-refer?
Very few. Yeah. I guess it would be around about 5%, no more than that.
Yeah.
But typically it's done within the surgery.
Yeah.
And everyone within the surgery has a little pad, which basically the system is that they can then give that pad to the patient to say, book in an appointment at the reception. And on the back it says all about what we do as social prescribers and the process that we go through and so on. Because the big thing is, you know, if we say a doctor referring, the doctor has 10 minutes with a patient.
Yeah.
If they want to get into a social prescribing discussion, that could very well easily take up 4 or 5 minutes of that 10 minutes, and doctors are very reluctant to do that.
Yeah, no, I understand. You know, their time is a very valuable resource.
So we wanted to have something that the doctor could say, look, there's lots of organisations out there that can help you. The social prescribers within the surgery have been fully trained on understanding what those organisations can do, and therefore, if you take that to reception, book in an appointment, they can help, and they can get through that within 30 seconds.
And have you found that the GPs and indeed the other staff kind of are on board with this? They're backing the whole programme that you're running.
Yes, you know, it's a little bit like turning the oil tanker around. It's certainly not the fastest thing that for adoption in the world, but typically the doctors got on board with it very quickly. And
I suppose they're at the sharp end. They see this stuff every day and thinking, you know, there's so much more we could do to help these people, but I've got my 10 minutes. I haven't got time.
Yeah, no, it's exactly that. That's the dichotomy that they have, that, yeah. That they're probably overrunning from the previous ones. So yeah. The last thing they want to do is get into a conversation that like explaining what social prescribing is at that point. But
yeah.
But people have come on board, and you know, the surgeries are very on board with it. And effectively, you know, apart from the security clearance that we all had to have, DBS checks, apart from that and giving us a room to use when we're there, it's a free service to the surgery. So
yeah.
It's a good win-win there.
Yeah, so you're a free resource and a very useful resource. So getting on to that, if people are listening to this and think, you know what, I think I've got some time. I'd like to be, if possible, as useful as Alan. You know, how can I get involved? You know, whether I'm in St. Albans or wherever I am. You know, what would you suggest if people are interested in helping out in being a link worker? You know, what should they do?
Well, I think talk to the surgery which is the first thing. That every surgery should have a patient participation group. So the volunteers are likely to be part of that group, at least initially. It could be much wider than that once it gets going, but initially that's obviously a group that could get involved. So to talk to your surgery to see if they're doing anything on social prescribing at the moment, mm-hmm. talk to the surgery about the patient participation group and getting involved with them and raising the issues of social prescribing through them. Look at the latest report that came out from NHS England I referred to. Because it really is a very comprehensive report about what's going on, what's happening, and how you can get involved.
Okay. Well, I'll try and make sure there's a link to that on my blog when this comes out. So if people are interested, they can, you know, find the link for sure.
I will get you the URL to have it, so it's very simple to put it there. And also I can put my email address on there as well. So if there's anything that anyone wants to talk about with me, I'd be very happy to do that.
Perfect. And presumably there's kind of a basic level of training that you go through to be able to do this. Is there? Tell us about that.
We developed the capability framework for what we need in a volunteer. So overall, it's understanding social prescribing. It's the sort of generic stuff around health and safety, around safeguarding, understanding, obviously, the local volunteer organisations that can help. And then it's simply around listening skills and probing skills and understanding the systems within the practice, because it's all, everything that we do is all, you know, for appointments are all set up within the system. All what we do as a consultation is all logged within the system. The follow-up calls are all logged and so on, because it's all coded within the system now. So there is a very comprehensive background to that. But getting people involved and onboarding people, there's a framework that we go through, a capability framework that we go through and develop their skills in those areas. Then the second stage is to shadow. So someone's starting up, well, we'll shadow someone that's already delivering it. Once they become more capable and through and confident through the shadowing process, they will go front up, and the main social prescriber will sort of shadow them and make sure that they're doing it right and chip in if necessary. And it's only when they're fully confident about doing it that they'll go live themselves.
Right.
And obviously, through the shadowing process, we have a quality assurance mechanism behind it that we can ensure as the volunteers coming on, we don't actually put them into a situation of delivering anything until we're fully confident with them.
Perfect. And then when you've been through this process, you can volunteer for almost as much or as little time as you want when you're up and running. Is that right?
Well, that's it. I mean, we have a schedule online, and so people just book themselves on to deliver it when they're ready and able to do it. And so it's down to the individuals as to how many they do and when they do it.
Brilliant. All right. Well, look, the whole thing, I've got to say, sounds absolutely fantastic. It sounds like it's really getting embedded, certainly in St Albans, and has helped a good number of people already. So it sounds like a wonderful thing. So, Alan, thank you so much for chatting to me about it.
It's my pleasure, and I'd be delighted to help everyone in any way that I can to take it from St Albans into the Main Street.
Relax Back UK is run by my daddy.
Please do remember, if you've got any questions or comments about any of the topics on this show, you can ask the questions or make comments on my blog, and the blog is on the website, which is relaxbackuk.com. Also, if you think you might like to try out a back app chair, if you're suffering from back pain or you're worried about what you think is poor posture and you'd like to try out a back app chair while sitting at your desk at work, you can do that. This is if you're in the UK. Go to the same website, relaxbackuk.com, click on the try out a back app chair button, fill in the details, and I will contact you and take care of that. Now, we will shortly hear from Shilpa Shah, who's a pharmacist with Lloyd's Pharmacy, about how pharmacy can actually be a very good place to go to for medical advice. It's often very accessible. There's quite often easy car parking, you know, all that. And you don't have to make an appointment. So, you know, you can get to see a pharmacist very quickly, often much quicker than a GP. And if that solves the issue, then everything can happen a lot more quickly and easily. And also it frees up the GP so that they can deal with other people.
Relax Back UK is run by my daddy.
We're often told to go and see a pharmacist first off, instead of maybe going to see the GP to try and alleviate some of the pressure on GPs. So I asked Shilpa Shah, she is a pharmacist with Lloyd's Pharmacy, if that is actually good advice.
Yes, 100%, Mike. I think there is a lot of pressure at the moment on the NHS. And I think there's so many things that our pharmacy teams can deal with. And it's not just the pharmacist. All our staff are specially trained as well. They have various training courses that they go on where they can talk to customers walking in about their minor ailments, about their long-term conditions. And actually, we're all trained on when to refer. If you do need to go to a doctor, we are able to refer you to a doctor or to A&E. And pharmacy is so accessible. I mean, Lloyd's Pharmacy, for example, has lots of pharmacies in supermarkets that are open from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. pretty much Monday to Saturday and open on Sundays as well, where you can't always get doctor's appointments, like after work, before work, etc. So definitely pharmacy is the place that you should go and talk to either the pharmacist or the pharmacy team about your condition, and they'll be able to advise you further.
Okay. And you find that that works quite well. So, you know, that the pharmacy doesn't get clogged up with people coming to ask for medical advice.
Don't get me wrong, we do get quite busy, but actually, if we can then, you know, talk to you about what kind of things can help you with your condition or your minor ailment, then actually it stops in the long run if you go to the doctors, get a prescription, and then kind of have to come back to us, or, you know, it kind of, I guess, nips it in the bud before the situation gets worse. So, you know, we're more than happy to support that, and we think it's the right way forward for the NHS.
Yeah, no, I mean, it certainly seems like a good plan to me. So when people take advantage of this service, what sorts of questions do you find they ask? Is anything sort of more popular, is the wrong word, but more frequent than others as far as problems are concerned people come to you with?
It can be very seasonal. So throughout the winter period, we get asked a lot of advice on colds and flu. And I guess in the summer, it's more around kind of hay fever. But then we've got people that might just have, you know, strained their back or played football and hurt their ankle. I just want to know if there's any tablets they can take for the pain. We get people with coming in with sort of stomach upset, you know, coughs and colds, just that sort of thing. So a lot of minor ailments. We do have people that have been diagnosed with conditions such as diabetes or any cardiovascular disease or COPD, for example, and they would ask for more specialist advice and normally sit down with the pharmacist to be able to support them with the medication they're on and give them further advice.
Okay, so a full range. What was that last one you mentioned? COPD?
COPD, yeah, so constructive, obstructive pulmonary disease. So it's to do with like asthma and breathing problems.
Okay, all right. So really, it's the full range of things. And so bringing on to that, I saw an article earlier this week saying that hay fever was coming early this year. I mean, it seems incredibly early for hay fever just now, but is that something you've noticed?
Yes, it is. So the reason it's coming earlier is because hay fever is an allergic reaction to pollen. If you've noticed, you've probably already, when you're driving around, seen blossom and some flowers sort of sprout out. I think I was at my sister's the other day and she's already got daffodils in the garden. So the pollen count is just a bit higher because the weather's been, we've had a really mild winter this year. Mm-hmm. So people have been coming in kind of mid to end of February, coming in with symptoms that they may think is a cold, but actually sometimes it is actually hay fever. Due to the higher pollen count that we've had compared to other years.
All right. And how do you tell the difference if someone comes in with a streaming nose between like a cold and a runny nose or hay fever?
I guess that when you've got a cold, you also get some aches and pains. You might get a headache, a bit of a temperature. But with hay fever, it's the sort of watery, itchy eyes, the scratchy throat. And the symptoms are very similar. But I guess if someone suffers from hay fever and they've not really had a cold all winter, then we would kind of put it down to hay fever. It would just, again, be the specialist advice. Just looking at the person and sort of knowing kind of how they're feeling and asking the right questions would lead us to hopefully the right conclusion.
Okay. And what can you actually do for hay fever? Because I get hay fever a bit, and I must admit, I just kind of get a bit grumpy and put up with it. Perhaps I should come and see you. Yeah. What would you suggest to me?
Well, you know, I think you can take tablets. So if your symptoms are worse during the day, you can take a tablet in the morning, which will hopefully keep your symptoms at bay. If they're worse at night, you take the tablet at night. If you only have watery eyes, you can just use eye drops to help with the itchy, watery eyes. If you have a blocked nose or runny nose, you get nasal sprays and congestion nasal sprays to help kind of clear up the nose. And there's different things that you can take, and we would tailor it to suit you and your lifestyle. So you may not have eye drops, for example. If you wear contact lenses, we may need to give you some different eye drops. You may not want tablets that cause drowsiness if you drive for your job, or if you're sitting exams at college or school. You don't really want to be drowsy. So it's about coming in, speaking to the pharmacy team. Doesn't have to be the pharmacist, who will then give you the best medication that's suitable for you. If you don't need medication and you're happy to put up with it, then that's something we'd also say, yeah, if that's what you're happy with. But some people do suffer quite badly and actually need the medication to make their day bearable.
Okay. Moving on to another affliction, which I think pretty much everyone gets at some stage in their life, and I'm sure you get asked about it frequently, and that's back pain. if someone hobbles into the pharmacy and, you know, they've obviously got back pain, now what do you do? What's the first thing you say? How do you treat them?
So I guess we just ask kind of what the pain is, when it started, how long they've had it. Is it related to anything else? Is it an injury that they were twisting funny? Do they drive a lot for their job? So it's all to do with posture. So I guess we ascertain really how long they've had the pain and how severe is the pain. And then we kind of, you know, treat it accordingly. So if it's just like a sporting injury, we would recommend that they rest as much as possible, but also just take some very mild painkillers to help with the pain. If it's something that they've had for a bit of, like, for longer time, we would suggest that they actually see their GP just to make sure that there's nothing else that they need to be concerned about. So it all depends on kind of, I guess, the questions that we ask and then the answers we get back from the patient.
Right. So if it's something that's shorter term, you know, someone's just twisted their back or something like that, and you give them some painkillers, what kind of painkillers might you suggest?
So we normally start with, you could just start with paracetamol if the pain is quite mild, maybe on a scale of 1 to 10, if the pain is 1 or 2. But you would you could also go on to what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which are things like ibuprofen. We would kind of just start with that. So it just helps take down any inflammation that may be associated with the back pain. And then we would kind of maybe give you a gel to rub on the area, like maybe a heat rub if it's mild. But if it's a bit stronger, again, maybe like an ibuprofen gel to help take down any inflammation. And then we'd kind of go up some steps. So maybe paracetamol with codeine in it as well, if the pain's quite severe, or you know, you need some help sleeping at night because of the pain. And then obviously we'd recommend you go to your GP, and then kind of they would have a pain step ladder that they work you up on, depending on what's caused the back pain and how long you've had it.
Okay, so that leads us on to something else I want to ask about, because you mentioned codeine, and that's a different class of drug, isn't it? What sort of drug is that?
So codeine is what we call an opioid. So in the pharmacy, you can only buy codeine for 3 days, because we don't recommend that you take it for longer than 3 days. If that's not helping, then actually we need to find out what's causing the pain, because it should really kind of help in those few days. It's been proven that codeine can be addictive, so we kind of only give 3 days worth out at any one time in a pharmacy, and then we recommend that you go to your doctor and get assessed a bit more formally if you still need something after that time.
Right. And well, apart from it being addictive, isn't there sort of proof now that these opioid drugs will work on pain in the short term, but actually if you end up taking them for weeks, they just stop working?
Yeah, I suppose it's just that your body then becomes used to them and they're not as effective, which is why you find that you then have to take maybe a higher dose or a higher strength, which is why we really do try and like look at what is causing the pain, because we're treating the symptoms, but what we want to get to the root cause of is what's causing it, so we can actually treat it at the site of the pain, which will mean that hopefully you won't have to take any medication going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned that actually for opioids you can become addicted. So do you end up with a situation where you recognize someone coming back every 3 days for buying more codeine? Has that ever happened to you?
Sometimes you do, but we have protocols in place that if a regular person is coming in and buying any drug more frequently than we'd recommend it to be used, that's when we have an alert system where the counter system would alert the pharmacist, and the pharmacist would come out and have a little chat with the person just to understand kind of why they're coming in so frequently and what can we do to support them, and do they need to sort of be escalated now to their GP, who can prescribe this for them under a bit more of a controlled manner.
Right. Okay. So it's quite well observed what people are buying when.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned a little earlier in our chat this idea of referring people onto GPs. Can you refer to other places as well? So, for instance, could you refer me to a physiotherapist if I was having, I don't know, ankle pain or knee pain or something?
Yeah, so we wouldn't I guess we would suggest that that's what you do next. So if you've sort of had tooth pain, we would actually say, right, we suggest that you go and see a dentist. If you had a problem with the eyes that we felt we couldn't treat in the pharmacy, we might recommend that you go and see an optician, and same with the problems with sort of bones, backs, etc. We may say we might recommend a physiotherapist. Or a GP, so it would depend on what's wrong with the patient who we'd recommend. So We don't directly refer you into them, but we kind of suggest who you should go and see, and then And then you can make that appointment.
That's what I meant, actually. You don't have powers of referral. So if you have to be referred on to someone else in the NHS, you have to do that via your GP.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. And so generally speaking, people really should be happy going to see their pharmacist to get advice if it's something that they want quickly and don't want to be waiting a week or two to see a GP. And then if the pharmacist thinks they need to see a GP, they'll tell them there anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've got it spot on, Mike. That's what people should be doing.
All right. Well, that sounds like good advice. That sounds like a good takeaway for people listening to this little chat. And it sounds like, you know, being a pharmacist is a very useful thing to do. I mean, would you recommend, if people are listening and they're wondering what to do with their lives, their career, to become a pharmacist?
Yeah, I definitely would. I think I really enjoy my job. It's so varied. You never see the same thing 2 days in a row. And actually, there's so much different opportunity. So I work in community pharmacy, but you can work in hospital pharmacy. You can be a pharmacist now in a GP surgery to help take the pressure off the GP. You can be a pharmacist in a care home. You can work in what we call industry, where you actually make the medication that comes out. So there's so much opportunity for pharmacists that definitely it's a great degree to do. And it's a great field and a career to work in.
Okay, that sounds like a fulfilling thing to do. Let me ask you another question, which is probably a bit unfair, but I'm going to ask it anyway. In the future, everyone's talking about IT and technology will change people's jobs. An awful lot of what you do, I would imagine, is checking out how drugs might work with each other. You know, you can't take some drugs with other particular drugs because they'll react together. That aspect of what you do, I can imagine being taken over by technology a little bit in the future, or does that happen already? What's the situation with that?
It sort of happens already. So although we know all the drug interactions, our computer systems, when we put them into the system, it will kind of say, oh, this drug reacts with this drug. Please warn the patient or speak to them about if it's suitable. So a lot of our technology already does that for us. So technology is definitely the way forward. I think we're going to be introducing, you can have online consultations with your GP and have a prescription sent directly to the pharmacy. But we've got to move with that because that is the future of any healthcare or anything at the moment. And we've just got to make sure that we're agile and pacey and we embrace it rather than being scared of it and trying fighting it, because it is the way forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, everyone's job is going to be changing in the future. That's just part of life, isn't it? So does Lloyd's Pharmacy have a website with advice to patients on, customers on?
Yeah. If you just go online and just look for Lloyd's Pharmacy, you'll be able to see our website, and we've got access there to our online doctor, to all the products that we sell in branches as well.
Okay. That sounds like a very good place to leave it. So people can look at your website if they want to, just to find out something a little bit sooner. So Shilpa, thank you very much indeed for chatting.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you very much to my guests on the show this week, and they were Alan Bellinger, he's a volunteer who runs the social prescribing program at the Maltings GP Surgery in St Albans, and also Shilpa Shah, she's a pharmacist with Lloyd's Pharmacy. And of course, also thank you to you for listening.
That was Mike Dilk of Relax Back UK. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next time.